Introduction to Allen's Wife and Other Tales by H. Rider Haggard, 1889. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Allen's Wife, the principal story in this volume, is now published for the first time. But Hunter Quatermain's story appeared some years since in a publication compiled for charitable purposes, A Tale of Three Lions in Atalanta and Long Odds in Macmillan's Magazine. Dedication. My dear Macumazahn, it was your native name which I borrowed at the christening of that Allen who has become as well known to me as any other friend I have. It is therefore fitting that I should dedicate to you this, his last tale, the story of his wife, and the history of some further adventures which befell him. They will remind you of many an African yarn. That with the baboons may recall an experience of your own which I did not share. And perhaps they will do more than this. Perhaps they will bring back to you some of the long-past romance of days that are lost to us. The country of which Allen Quatermain tells his tales is now, for the most part, as well known and explored as are the fields of Norfolk, where we shot and trekked and galloped, scarcely seeing the face of civilized man. There the gold-seeker builds his cities. The shadow of the flag of Britain has, for a while, ceased to fall upon the Transvaal plains. The game has gone. The misty charm of the morning has become the glare of day. All is changed. The blue gums that we planted in the garden of the palatial must be large trees by now, and the palatial itself has passed from us. Jess sat in it waiting for her lover after we were gone. There she nursed him back to life. But Jess is dead, and strangers own it, or perhaps it is a ruin. For us too, Macumazahn, as for the land we loved, the mystery and promise of the morning are outworn. The midday sun burns overhead, and at times the way is weary. Few of those we knew are left. Some are victims to battle and murder, their bones strew the veldt. Death has taken some in a more gentle fashion. Others are hidden from us, we know not where. We might well fear to return to that land, lest we also should see ghosts. But though we walk apart today, the past yet looks upon us with its unalterable eyes. Still we can remember many a boyish enterprise and adventure lightly undertaken, which now would strike us as hazardous indeed. Still we can recall the long familiar line of the Pretoria horse, the face of war and panic, the weariness of midnight patrols, aye, and hear the roar of guns echoed from the shameful hill. To you then, Macumazahn, in perpetual memory of those eventful years of youth which we passed together in the African towns and on the African veldt, I dedicate these pages, subscribing myself now, as always, your sincere friend, Indanda. To Arthur H. D. Cochrane, Esquire. End of introduction. Part 1 of Allen's Wife and Other Tales by H. Rider Haggard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Allen's Wife, Chapter 1, Early Days. It may be remembered that in the last pages of his diary, written just before his death, Allen Quatermain makes allusion to his long-dead wife, stating that he has written of her fully elsewhere. When his death was known, his papers were handed to myself as his literary executor. Among them I found two manuscripts, of which the following is one. The other is simply a record of events wherein Mr. Quatermain was not personally concerned. A Zulu novel, the story of which was told to him by the hero many years after the tragedy had occurred. But with this we have nothing to do at present. I have often thought, Mr. Quatermain's manuscript begins, that I would set down on paper the events connected with my marriage and the loss of my most dear wife. Many years have now passed since that event, and to some extent time has softened the old grief, though heaven knows it is still keen enough. On two or three occasions I have even begun the record. Once I gave it up because the writing of it depressed me beyond bearing, once because I was suddenly called away upon a journey, and the third time because a Kaffir boy found my manuscripts convenient for lighting the kitchen fire. But now that I am at leisure here in England, I will make a fourth attempt. If I succeed, the story may serve to interest someone in after years when I am dead and gone. Before that, I should not wish it to be published. It is a wild tale enough, and suggests some curious reflections. I am the son of a missionary. My father was originally curate in charge of a small parish in Oxfordshire. He had already been some years married to my dear mother when he went there, and he had four children, of whom I was the youngest. I remember faintly the place where we lived. It was an ancient, long, grey house, facing the road. There was a very large tree of some sort in the garden. It was hollow, and we children used to play about inside of it and knock knots of wood from the rough bark. We all slept in a kind of attic, and my mother always came and kissed us when we were in bed. I used to wake up and see her bending over me, a candle in her hand. There was a curious kind of pole projecting from the wall over my bed. Once I was dreadfully frightened because my eldest brother made me hang to it by my hands. That is all I remember about our old home. It has been pulled down long ago, or I would journey there to see it. A little further down the road was a large house with big iron gates to it, and on the top of the gate pillars sat two stone lions, which were so hideous that I was afraid of them. Perhaps this sentiment was prophetic. One could see the house by peeping through the bars of the gates. It was a gloomy-looking place with a tall yew-hedge round it. But in summer-time, some flowers grew about the sundial in the grass plat. This house was called the Hall, and Squire Carson lived there. One Christmas, it must have been the Christmas before my father emigrated, or I should not remember it, we children went to a Christmas tree festivity at the Hall. There was a great party there, and footmen wearing red waistcoats stood at the door. In the dining room, which was panelled with black oak, was the Christmas tree. Squire Carson stood in front of it. He was a tall, dark man, very quiet in his manners, and he wore a bunch of seals on his waistcoat. We used to think him old, but as a matter of fact, he was then not more than 40. He had been, as I afterwards learned, a great traveller in his youth, and some 6 or 7 years before this date he married a lady who was half a Spaniard, a papist, my father called her. I can remember her well. She was small and very pretty, with a rounded figure, large black eyes, and glittering teeth. She spoke English with a curious accent. I suppose that I must have been a funny child to look at, and I know that my hair stood up on my head then as it does now, for I still have a sketch of myself that my mother made of me, in which this peculiarity is strongly marked. On the occasion of the Christmas tree, I remember that Mrs. Carson turned to a tall, foreign-looking gentleman who stood beside her, and tapping him affectionately on the shoulder with her gold eyeglasses, said, "Look, cousin, look at that droll little boy with the big brown eyes. His hair is like a, what do you call him, scrubbing brush. Oh, what a droll little boy." The tall gentleman pulled at his moustache, and taking Mrs. Carson's hand in his, began to smooth my hair down with it, till I heard her whisper, "Leave go my hand, cousin. Thomas is looking like the thunderstorm." Thomas was the name of Mr. Carson, her husband. After that, I hid myself as well as I could behind a chair, for I was shy, and watched little Stella Carson, who was the squire's only child, giving the children presents off the tree. She was dressed as Father Christmas, with some soft white stuff around her lovely little face, and she had large dark eyes, which I thought more beautiful than anything I had ever seen. At last it came to my turn to receive a present. Oddly enough, considered in the light of future events, it was a large monkey. Stella reached it down from one of the lower boughs of the tree, and handed it to me, saying, "That is my Christmas present to you, little Allan Quatermain." As she did so, her sleeve, which was covered with cotton wool, spangled over with something that shone, touched one of the tapers and caught fire, how I do not know, and the flame ran up her arm towards her throat. She stood quite still. I suppose that she was paralysed with fear, and the ladies who were near screamed very loud, but did nothing. Then some impulse seized me. Perhaps instinct would be a better word to use, considering my age. I threw myself upon the child, and beating at the fire with my hands, mercifully succeeded in extinguishing it before it really got hold. My wrists were so badly scorched that they had to be wrapped up in wool for a long time afterwards, but with the exception of a single burn upon her throat, little Stella Carson was not much hurt. This is all that I remember about the Christmas tree at the hall. What happened afterwards is lost to me, but to this day in my sleep I sometimes see little Stella's sweet face and the stare of terror in her dark eyes as the fire ran up her arm. This, however, is not wonderful, for I had, humanly speaking, saved the life of her who was destined to be my wife. The next event which I can recall clearly is that my mother and three brothers all fell ill of fever, owing, as I afterwards learned, to the poisoning of our well by some evil-minded person who threw a dead sheep into it. It must have been while they were ill that Squire Carson came one day to the vicarage. The weather was still cold, for there was a fire in the study, and I sat before the fire writing letters on a piece of paper with a pencil, while my father walked up and down the room talking to himself. Afterwards I knew that he was praying for the lives of his wife and children. Presently a servant came to the door and said that someone wanted to see him. "It's the squire, sir," said the maid, "and he says he particularly wishes to see you." "Very well," answered my father, wearily, and presently Squire Carson came in. His face was white and haggard, and his eyes shone so fiercely that I was afraid of him.
"Forgive me for intruding on you at such a time, Quatermain," he said in a hoarse voice, "but tomorrow I leave this place for ever, and I wish to speak to you before I go. Indeed, I must speak to you."
"Shall I send Allan away?" said my father, pointing to me.
"No, let him bide. He will not understand."
Nor indeed did I at the time, but I remembered every word, and in after years their meaning grew on me.
"First tell me," he went on, "how are they?" And he pointed upwards with his thumb. "My wife and two of the boys are beyond hope," my father answered with a groan. "I do not know how it will go with the third."
"The Lord's will be done."
"The Lord's will be done," the squire echoed solemnly. "And now, Quatermain, listen. My wife's gone."
"Gone?"
my father answered.
"Who with?"
"With that foreign cousin of hers. It seems from the letter she left that she always cared for him, not for me. She married me because she thought me a rich English milord. Now she has run through my property, or most of it, and gone, I don't know where. Luckily she did not care to encumber her new career with the child. Stella is left to me."
"That is what comes of marrying a papist, Carson," said my father. That was his fault. He was as good and charitable a man as ever lived, but he was bigoted.
"What are you going to do? Follow her?"
He laughed bitterly in answer.
"Follow her?" he said. "Why should I follow her? If I met her, I might kill her, or him, or both of them, because of the disgrace they have brought upon my child's name. No, I never want to look upon her face again. I trusted her, I tell you, and she has betrayed me. Let her go and find her fate. But I am going too. I am weary of my life."
"Surely, Carson, surely," said my father, "you do not mean—"
"No, no, not that. Death comes soon enough, but I will leave this civilized world, which is a lie. We will go right away into the wilds, I and my child, and hide our shame. Where? I do not know where. Anywhere. so long as there are no white faces, no smooth, educated tongues.
You are mad, Carson, my father answered. How will you live? How will you educate Stella? Be a man and wear it down.
I will be a man, and I will wear it down, but not here, Quatermain. Education? Was not she that woman who was my wife? Was not she highly educated? The cleverest woman in the county, forsooth. Too clever for me, Quatermain. Too clever by half. No, no, Stella shall be brought up in a different school. If it be possible, she shall forget her very name. Good-bye, old friend. Good-bye for ever. Do not try to find me out. Henceforth I shall be like one dead to you and all I knew.
And he was gone. Mad, said my father with a heavy sigh. His trouble has turned his brain, but he will think better of it. At that moment the nurse came hurrying in and whispered something in his ear. My father's face turned deadly pale. He clutched at the table to support himself, then staggered from the room. My mother was dying. It was some days afterwards, I do not know exactly how long, that my father took me by the hand and led me upstairs into the big room which had been my mother's bedroom. There she lay, dead in her coffin with flowers in her hand. Along the wall of the room were arranged three little white beds, and on each of the beds lay one of my brothers. They all looked as though they were asleep, and they all had flowers in their hands. My father told me to kiss them, because I should not see them any more, and I did so, though I was very frightened. I did not know why. Then he took me in his arms and kissed me. "The Lord hath given," he said, "and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." I cried very much, and he took me downstairs, and after that I have only a confused memory of men dressed in black, carrying heavy burdens towards the grey churchyard. Next comes a vision of a great ship and wide tossing waters. My father could no longer bear to live in England after the loss that had fallen on him, and made up his mind to emigrate to South Africa. We must have been poor at that time. Indeed, I believe that a large portion of our income went from my father on my mother's death. At any rate, we travelled with the steerage passengers, and the intense discomfort of the journey with the rough ways of our fellow emigrants still remain upon my mind. At last it came to an end, and we reached Africa, which I was not to leave again for many, many years. In those days, civilization had not made any great progress in southern Africa. My father went up the country and became a missionary among the Kaffirs, near to where the town of Cradock now stands. And here I grew to manhood. There were a few Boer farmers in the neighbourhood, and gradually a little settlement of whites gathered round our mission station. A drunken Scotch blacksmith and wheelwright was about the most interesting character, who, when he was sober, could quote the Scottish poet Burns and the Ingoldsby legends, then recently published, literally by the page. It was from him that I contracted a fondness for the latter amusing writings, which has never left me. Burns I never cared for so much, probably because of the Scottish dialect which repelled me. What little education I got was from my father, but I never had much leaning towards books, nor he much time to teach them to me. On the other hand, I was always a keen observer of the ways of men and nature. By the time that I was 20, I could speak Dutch and three or four Kaffir dialects perfectly, and I doubt if there was anybody in South Africa who understood native ways of thought and action more completely than I did. Also, I was really a very good shot and horseman, and I think, as indeed my subsequent career proves to have been the case, a great deal tougher than the majority of men. Though I was then, as now, light and small, nothing seemed to tire me. I could bear any amount of exposure and privation, and I never met the native who was my master in feats of endurance. Of course, all that is different now. I'm speaking of my early manhood.
It may be wondered that I did not run absolutely wild in such surroundings, but I was held back from this by my father's society. He was one of the gentlest and most refined men that I ever met. Even the most savage Kaffir loved him, and his influence was a very good one for me. He used to call himself one of the world's failures. Would that there were more such failures. Every evening when his work was done, he would take his prayer book, and sitting on the little stoop or veranda of our station, would read the evening psalms to himself. Sometimes there was not light enough for this, but it made no difference. He knew them all by heart. When he had finished, he would look out across the cultivated lands where the mission Kaffirs had their huts. But I knew it was not these he saw, but rather the grey English church, and the graves ranged side by side before the yew near the wicket gate. It was there on the stoop that he died. He had not been well, and one evening I was talking to him, and his mind went back to Oxfordshire and my mother. He spoke of her a good deal, saying that she had never been out of his mind for a single day during all those years, and that he rejoiced to think that he was drawing near that land, whither she had gone. Then he asked me if I remembered the night when Squire Carson came into the study at the vicarage, and told him that his wife had run away, and that he was going to change his name and bury himself in some remote land. I answered that I remembered it perfectly. "I wonder where he went to," said my father, "and if he and his daughter Stella are still alive. Well, well, I shall never meet them again. But life is a strange thing, Alan, and you may. If you ever do, give them my kind love." After that, I left him. We had been suffering more than usual from the depredations of the Kaffir thieves who stole our sheep at night, and, as I had done before, and not without success, I determined to watch the kraal and see if I could catch them. Indeed, it was from this habit of mine of watching at night that I first got my native name of Macumazahn, which may be roughly translated as "he who sleeps with one eye open." So I took my rifle and rose to go, but he called me to him and kissed me on the forehead, saying, "God bless you, Alan. I hope that you will think of your old father sometimes, and that you will lead a good and happy life." I remember that I did not much like his tone at the time, but set it down to an attack of low spirits, to which he grew very subject as the years went on. I went down to the kraal and watched till within an hour of sunrise. Then, as no thieves appeared, returned to the station. As I came near, I was astonished to see a figure sitting in my father's chair. At first I thought it must be a drunken Kaffir, then that my father had fallen asleep there. And so he had, for he was dead. End of part one. Part 2 of Alan's Wife and Other Tales by H. Rider Haggard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Alan's Wife, Chapter 2, The Firefight. When I had buried my father and seen a successor installed in his place, for the station was the property of the society, I set to work to carry out a plan which I had long cherished but been unable to execute, because it would have involved separation from my father. Put shortly, it was to undertake a trading journey of exploration right through the countries now known as the Free State and the Transvaal, and as much further north as I could go. It was an adventurous scheme, for though the emigrant Boers had begun to occupy positions in these territories, they were still, to all practical purposes, unexplored. But I was now alone in the world, and it mattered little what became of me. So, driven on by the overmastering love of adventure, which, old as I am, will perhaps still be my cause of death, I determined to undertake the journey. Accordingly, I sold such stock and goods as we had upon the station, reserving only the two best wagons and two spans of oxen. The proceeds I invested in such goods as were then in fashion for trading purposes, and in guns and ammunition. The guns would have moved any modern explorer to merriment, but such as they were, I managed to do a good deal of execution with them. One of them was a single-barrelled, smooth bore, fitted for percussion caps, a roar, as we called it, which threw a 3-ounce ball and was charged with a handful of coarse black powder. Many is the elephant that I killed with that roar, although it generally knocked me backwards when I fired it, which I only did under compulsion. The best of the lot, perhaps, was a double-barrelled No. 12 shotgun, but it had flintlocks. Also, there were some old tower muskets, which might or might not throw straight at 70 yards. I took 6 Kaffirs with me, and 3 good horses, which were supposed to be salted, that is, proof against the sickness. Among the Kaffirs was an old fellow named Indabazimbi, which, translated, means tongue of iron. I suppose he got this name from his strident voice and exhaustless eloquence. The man was a great character in his way. He had been a noted witch doctor among a neighbouring tribe, and came to the station under the following circumstances, which, as he plays a considerable part in this history, are perhaps worth recording. 2 years before my father's death, I had occasion to search the country round for some lost oxen. After a long and useless quest, it occurred to me that I had better go to the place where the oxen were bred by a Kaffir chief, whose name I forget, but whose kraal was about 50 miles from our station. There I journeyed, and found the oxen safe at home. The chief entertained me handsomely, and on the following morning I went to pay my respects to him before leaving, and was somewhat surprised to find a collection of some hundreds of men and women sitting round him, anxiously watching the sky in which the thunderclouds were banking up in a very ominous way. "You had better wait, white man," said the chief, "and see the rain doctors fight the lightning." I inquired what he meant, and learned that this man, Indabazimbi, had for some years occupied the position of wizarding chief to the tribe, although he was not a member of it, having been born in the country now known as Zululand. But a son of the chief's, a man of about 30, had lately set up as a rival in supernatural powers. This irritated Indabazimbi beyond measure, and a quarrel ensued between the two witch-doctors that resulted in a challenge to trial by lightning being given and accepted. These were the conditions. The rivals must await the coming of a serious thunderstorm. No ordinary tempest would serve their turn. Then, carrying assegais in their hands, they must take their stand within 50 paces of each other, upon a certain patch of ground where the big thunderbolts were observed to strike continually, and by the exercise of their occult powers and invocations to the lightning, must strive to avert death from themselves and bring it on their rival. The terms of this singular match had been arranged a month previously, but no storm worthy of the occasion had arisen. Now the local weather prophets believed it to be brewing. I inquired what would happen if neither of the men were struck, and was told they must then wait for another storm. If they escaped the second time, however, they would be held to be equal in power, and be jointly consulted by the tribe upon occasions of importance. The prospect of being a spectator of so unusual a sight overcame my desire to be gone, and I accepted the chief's invitation to see it out. Before midday I regretted it, for though the western heavens grew darker and darker, and the still air heralded the coming of the storm, yet it did not come. By 4 o'clock, however, it became obvious that it must burst soon. At sunset, the old chief said, and in the company of the whole assembly, I moved down to the place of combat. The kraal was built on the top of a hill, and below it, the land sloped gently to the banks of a river, about 1/2 mile away. On the hither side of the bank was the piece of land that was, the natives said, loved of the lightning. Here the magicians took up their stand, while the spectators grouped themselves on the hillside, about 200 yards away, which was, I thought, rather too near to be pleasant. When we had sat there for a while, my curiosity overcame me, and I asked leave of the chief to go down and inspect the arena. He said I might do so at my own risk. I told him that the fire from above would not hurt white men, and went to find that the spot was a bed of iron ore, thinly covered with grass, which of course accounted for its attracting the lightning from the storms as they travelled along the line of the river. At each end of this ironstone area were placed the combatants, Indabazimbi facing the east, and his rival the west, and before each there burned a little fire made of some scented root. Moreover, they were dressed in all the paraphernalia of their craft, snakeskins, fish bladders, and I know not what beside, while round their necks hung circlets of baboons' teeth and bones from human hands. First I went to the western end where the chief's son stood. He was pointing with his assegai towards the advancing storm, and invoking in it a voice of great excitement.
"Come, fire, and lick up Indabazimbi! Hear me, storm devil, and lick Indabazimbi with your red tongue! Spit on him with your rain! Whirl him away in your breath! Make him as nothing! Melt the marrow in his bones! Run into his heart and burn away the lies! Show all the people who is the true witch-finder! Let me not be put to shame in the eyes of this white man!"
Thus he spoke, or rather chanted, and all the while rubbed his broad chest, for he was a very fine man, with some filthy compound of medicine, or muti. After a while, getting tired of his song, I walked across the ironstone to where Indabazimbi sat by his fire. He was not chanting at all, but his performance was much more impressive. It consisted in staring at the eastern sky, which was perfectly clear of cloud, and every now and again beckoning at it with his finger, then turning round to point with the assegai towards his rival. For a while I looked at him in silence. He was a curious, wizened man, apparently over 50 years of age, with thin hands that looked as tough as wire. His nose was much sharper than is usual among these races, and he had a queer habit of holding his head sideways like a bird when he spoke, which, in addition to the humour that lurked in his eye, gave him a most comical appearance. Another strange thing about him was that he had a single white lock of hair among his black wool. At last I spoke to him. "Indabazimbi, my friend," I said, "you may be a good witch-doctor, but you are certainly a fool. It is no good beckoning at the blue sky while your enemy is getting a start with the storm.
You may be clever, but don't think you know everything, white man," the old fellow answered in a high, cracked voice, and with something like a grin.
"They call you Iron Tongue," I went on. "You had better use it, or the storm devil won't hear you."
"The fire from above runs down iron," he answered, "so I keep my tongue quiet. Oh, yes, let him curse away. I put him out presently. Look now, white man."
I looked, and in the eastern sky there grew a cloud. At first it was small, though very black, but it gathered with extraordinary rapidity. This was odd enough, but as I had seen the same thing happen before, it did not particularly astonish me. It is by no means unusual in Africa for two thunderstorms to come up at the same time from different points of the compass. "You had better get on, Indabazimbi," I said. "The big storm is coming along fast, and will soon eat up that baby of yours," and I pointed to the west.
"Babies sometimes grow to giants, white man," said Indabazimbi, beckoning away vigorously. "Look now at my cloud child."
I looked. The eastern storm was spreading itself from earth to sky, and in shape resembled an enormous man. There was its head, its shoulders, and its legs. Yes, it was like a huge giant travelling across the heavens. The light of the setting sun, escaping from beneath the lower edge of the western storm, shot across the intervening space in a sheet of splendour, and lighting upon the advancing figure of cloud, wrapped its middle in hues of glory, too wonderful to be described. But beneath and above this glowing belt, His feet and head were black as jet. Presently, as I watched, an awful flash of light shot from the head of the cloud, circled it about as though with a crown of living fire, and vanished.
"Aha!" chuckled old Indaba-Zimbi. "My little boy is putting on his man's ring."
And he tapped the gum ring on his own head, which natives assume when they reach a certain age and dignity.
"Now, white man, unless you are a bigger wizard than either of us, you had better clear off, for the firefight is about to begin."
I thought this sound advice.
"Good luck go with you, my black uncle," I said.
"I hope you don't feel the iniquities of a misspent life weighing on you at the last."
"You look after yourself and think of your own sins, young man," he answered with a grim smile,
and taking a pinch of snuff, while at that very moment a flash of lightning, I don't know from which storm, struck the ground within 30 paces of me. That was enough for me. I took to my heels, and as I went, I heard old Indaba-Zimbi's dry chuckle of amusement. I climbed the hill till I came to where the chief was sitting with his indunas, or headmen, and sat down near to him. I looked at the man's face and saw that he was intensely anxious for his son's safety, and by no means confident of the young man's powers to resist the magic of Indaba-Zimbi. He was talking in a low voice to the induna next to him. I affected to take no notice and to be concentrating my attention on the novel scene before me, but in those days I had very quick ears and caught the drift of the conversation.
"Hearken," the chief was saying, "if the magic of Indaba-Zimbi prevails against my son, I will endure him no more. Of this I am sure, that when he has slain my son, he will slay me also, and make himself chief in my place. I fear Indaba-Zimbi. Woo!"
"Black one," answered the induna, "wizards die as dogs die, and once dead, dogs bark no more."
"And once dead," said the chief, "wizards work no more spells."
And he bent and whispered in the induna's ear, looking at the assegai in his hand as he whispered.
"Good, my father, good," said the induna presently. "It shall be done tonight if the lightning does not do its first."
"A bad lookout for old Indaba-Zimbi," I said to myself. "They mean to kill him." Then I thought no more of the matter for a while. The scene before me was too tremendous. The two storms were rapidly rushing together. Between them was a gulf of blue sky, and from time to time, flashes of blinding light passed across this gulf, leaping from cloud to cloud. I remember that they reminded me of the story of the heathen god Jove and his thunderbolts. The storm that was shaped like a giant and ringed with the glory of the sinking sun made an excellent Jove, and I am sure that the bolts which leapt from it could not have been surpassed even in mythological times. Oddly enough, as yet the flashes were not followed by thunder. A deadly stillness lay upon the place. The cattle stood silently on the hillside. Even the natives were awed to silence. Dark shadows crept along the bosom of the hills. The river to the right and left was hidden in wreaths of cloud, but before us and beyond the combatants, it shone like a line of silver between the narrowing space of open sky. Now the western tempest was scrawled all over with lines of intolerable light, while the inky head of the cloud giant to the east was continually suffused with a white and deadly glow that came and went in pulses, as though a blood of flame was being pumped into it from the heart of the storm. The silence deepened and deepened. The shadows grew blacker and blacker. Then suddenly, all nature began to moan beneath the breath of an icy wind. On sped the wind. The smooth surface of the river was ruffled by it into little waves. The tall grass bowed low before it, and in its wake came the hissing sound of furious rain. Ah, the storms had met! From each there burst an awful blaze of dazzling flame, and now the hill on which we sat rocked at the noise of the following thunder. The light went out of the sky. Darkness fell suddenly on the land, but not for long. Presently, the whole landscape grew vivid in the flashes. It appeared and disappeared. Now everything was visible for miles. Now even the men at my side vanished in the blackness. The thunder rolled and cracked and pealed like the trump of doom. Whirlwinds tore round, lifting dust and even stones high into the air, and in a low, continuous undertone rose the hiss of the rushing rain. I put my hand before my eyes to shield them from the terrible glare, and looked beneath it towards the lists of ironstone. As flash followed flash, from time to time I caught sight of the two wizards. They were slowly advancing towards one another, each pointing at his foe with the assegai in his hand. I could see their every movement, and it seemed to me that the chain lightning was striking the ironstone all around them. Suddenly the thunder and lightning ceased for a minute. Everything grew black, and except for the rain, silent. "It is over one way or the other, chief," I called out into the darkness.
"Wait, white man, wait," answered the chief, in a voice thick with anxiety and fear.
Hardly were the words out of his mouth when the heavens were lit up again till they literally seemed to flame. There were the men, not 10 paces apart. A great flash fell between them. I saw them stagger beneath the shock. Indabazimbi recovered himself first. At any rate, when the next flash came, he was standing bolt upright, pointing with his assegai towards his enemy. The chief's son was still on his legs, but he was staggering like a drunken man, and the assegai had fallen from his hand. Darkness, then again a flash more fearful, if possible, than any that had gone before. To me it seemed to come from the east, right over the head of Indabazimbi. At that instant, I saw the chief's son, wrapped as it were in the heart of it. Then the thunder pealed, the rain burst over us like a torrent, and I saw no more. The worst of the storm was done, but for a while the darkness was so dense that we could not move, nor indeed was I inclined to leave the safety of the hillside, where the lightning was never known to strike, and venture down to the ironstone. Occasionally there still came flashes, but search as we would, we could see no trace of either of the wizards. For my part, I believed that they were both dead. Now the clouds slowly rolled away down the course of the river, and with them went the rain, and now the stars shone out in their wake.
"Let us go and see," said the old chief, rising and shaking the water from his hair. "The firefight is ended. Let us go and see who has conquered."
I rose and followed him, dripping, as though I had swum 100 yards with my clothes on, and after me came all the people of the kraal. We reached the spot. Even in that light I could see where the ironstone had been split and fused by the thunderbolts. While I was staring about me, I suddenly heard the chief, who was on my right, give a low moan and saw the people cluster round him. I went up and looked. There, on the ground, lay the body of his son. It was a dreadful sight. The hair was burnt off his head, the copper rings upon his arms were fused, the assegai handle which lay near was nearly shivered into threads, and when I took hold of his arm, it seemed to me that every bone of it was broken. The men with the chief stood gazing silently while the women wailed.
"Great is the magic of Indabazimbi," said a man at length.
The chief turned and struck him a heavy blow with the kerry in his hand.
"Great or not, thou dog, he shall die," he cried, "and so shalt thou, if thou singest his praises so loudly."
I said nothing, but thinking it probable that Indabazimbi had shared the fate of his enemy, I went to look. But I could see nothing of him. And at length, being thoroughly chilled with the wet, started back to my wagon to change my clothes. On reaching it, I was rather surprised to see a strange Kaffir seated on the driving box, wrapped up in a blanket.
"Hallo, come out of that," I said.
The figure on the box slowly unrolled the blanket and with great deliberation took a pinch of snuff.
"It was a good firefight, white man, was it not?" said
Indabazimbi in his high, cracked voice.
"But he never had a chance against me, poor boy. He knew nothing about it. See, white man, what comes of presumption in the young. It is sad, very sad, but I made the flashes fly, didn't I?"
"You old humbug," I said. "Unless you are careful, you will soon learn what comes of presumption in the old, for your chief is after you with an assegai, and it will take all your magic to dodge that."
"Now you don't say so," said Indabazimbi, clambering off the wagon with rapidity, "and all because of this wretched upstart. There's gratitude for you, white man. I expose him, and they want to kill me. Well, thank you for the hint. We shall meet again before long."
And he was gone like a shot, and not too soon, for just then some of the chief's men came up to the wagon. On the following morning, I started homewards. The first face I saw on arriving at the station was that of Indabazimbi.
"How do you do, Macumazahn?" he said, holding his head on one side and nodding his white lock. "I hear you are Christians here, and I want to try a new religion. Mine must be a bad one, seeing that my people wanted to kill me for exposing an impostor."
End of part 2. Part 3 of Alan's Wife and Other Tales by H. Rider Haggard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Alan's Wife, Chapter 3, Northwards. I make no apology to myself or to anybody who may happen to read this narrative in future for having set out the manner of my meeting with Indabazimbi, first because it was curious, and secondly because he takes some hand in the subsequent events. If that old man was a humbug, he was a very clever one. What amount of truth there was in his pretensions to supernatural powers is not for me to determine, though I may have my own opinion on the subject, but there was no mistake as to the extraordinary influence he exercised over his fellow natives. Also, he quite got round my poor father. At first the old gentleman declined to have him at the station, for he had a great horror of these Kaffir wizards or witch-finders, but Indabazimbi persuaded him that he was anxious to investigate the truths of Christianity, and challenged him to discussion. The argument lasted for 2 years, to the time of my father's death indeed. At the conclusion of each stage, Indabazimbi would remark, in the words of the Roman governor, almost praying white man, "Thou persuadest me to become a Christian." But he never quite became one. Indeed, I do not think he ever meant to. It was to him that my father addressed his letters to a native doubter. This work, which, unfortunately, remains in manuscript, is full of wise saws and learned instances. It ought to be published together with a précis of the doubter's answers, which were verbal. So the talk went on. If my father had lived, I believe it would be going on now, for both the disputants were quite inexhaustible. Meanwhile, Indabazimbi was allowed to live in the station on condition that he practised no witchcraft, which my father firmly believed to be a wile of the devil. He said that he would not, but for all that, there was never an ox lost or a sudden death, but he was consulted by those interested. When he had been with us a year, a deputation came to him from the tribe he had left, asking him to return. Things had not gone well with them since he went away, they said, and now the chief, his enemy, was dead. Old Indabazimbi listened to them till they had done, and as he listened, raked sand into a little heap with his toes. Then he spoke, pointing to the little heap. "There is your tribe today," he said. Then he lifted his heel and stamped the heap flat. "There is your tribe before 3 moons are gone. Nothing is left of it. You drove me away. I will have no more to do with you. But when you are being killed, think of my words." The messengers went. 3 months afterwards, I heard that the whole community had been wiped out by an impi of raiding Pondos. When I was at length ready to start upon my expedition, I went to old Indabazimbi to say goodbye to him, and was rather surprised to find him engaged in rolling up medicine, assegais, and other sundries in his blankets. "Goodbye, Indabazimbi," I said. "I am going to trek north." "Yes, Macumazahn," he answered with his head on one side. "And so am I. I want to see that country. We will go together." "Will we?" I said. "Wait till you are asked, you old humbug." "You had better ask me then, Macumazahn. But if you don't, you will never come back alive. Now that the old chief, my father, is gone to where the storms come from," and he nodded to the sky, "I feel myself getting into bad habits again. So last night I just threw up the bones and worked out about your journey. And I can tell you this, that if you don't take me, you will die. And, what is more, you will lose one who is dearer to you than life in a strange fashion. So just because you gave me that hint a couple of years ago, I made up my mind to come with you." "Don't talk stuff to me," I said. "Ah, very well, Macumazahn, very well. But what happened to my own people 6 months ago, and what did I tell the messengers would happen? They drove me away, and they are gone. If you drive me away, you will soon be gone too." And he nodded his white lock at me and smiled. Now I was not more superstitious than other people, but somehow old Indabazimbi impressed me. Also, I knew his extraordinary influence over every class of native, and bethought me that he might be useful in that way. "All right," I said, "I appoint you witch-finder to the expedition, without pay." "First serve, then ask for wages," he answered. "I am glad to see that you have enough imagination not to be altogether a fool, like most white men, Macumazahn." "Yes, yes, it is want of imagination that makes people fools. They won't believe what they can't understand. You can't understand my prophecies any more than the fool at the kraal could understand that I was his master with the lightning. Well, it is time to trek. But if I were you, Macumazahn, I should take one wagon, not two." "Why?" I said. "Because you will lose your wagons, and it is better to lose one than two." "Oh, nonsense," I said. "All right, Macumazahn, live and learn." And without another word he walked to the foremost wagon, put his bundle into it, and climbed onto the front seat. So, having bid an affectionate adieu to my white friends, including the old Scotchman who got drunk in honour of the event, and quoted Burns till the tears ran down his face, at length I started, and travelled slowly northwards. For the first 3 weeks, nothing very particular befell me. Such Kaffirs as we came into contact with were friendly, and game literally swarmed. Nobody living in those parts of South Africa nowadays can have the remotest idea of what the veldt was like, even 30 years ago. Often and often I have crept shivering onto my wagon box, just as the sun rose and looked out. At first one would see nothing but a vast field of white mist, suffused towards the east by a tremulous golden glow, through which the tops of stony kopjes stood up like gigantic beacons. From the dense mist would come strange sounds, snorts, gruntings, bellows, and the thunder of countless hooves. Presently, this great curtain would grow thinner, then it would melt, as the smoke from a pipe melts into the air, and for miles on miles the wide rolling country, interspersed with bush, open to the view. But it was not tenantless as it is now, for as far as the eye could reach, it would be literally black with game. Here to the right might be a herd of wildebeeste that could not number less than 2,000. Some were grazing, some gambolled, whisking their white tails into the air, while all round the old bulls stood upon hillocks, sniffing suspiciously at the breeze. There in front, 1,000 yards away, though to the unpracticed eye they looked much closer because of the dazzling clearness of the atmosphere, was a great herd of springbok, trekking along in single file. Ah, they have come to the wagon track and do not like the look of it. What will they do? Go back? Not a bit of it. It is nearly 30 feet wide, but that is nothing to a springbok. See, the first of them bounds into the air like a ball. How beautifully the sunshine gleams upon his golden hide. He has cleared it, and the others come after him in numberless succession, all except the fawns, who cannot jump so far, and have to scamper over the doubtful path with a terrified "Mah!" What is that yonder, moving above the tops of the mimosa in the little dell at the foot of the kopje? Giraffes, by George, 3 of them. There will be marrow bones for supper tonight. Hark, the ground shakes behind us, and over the brow of the rise rush a vast herd of blesbok. On they come at full gallop. Their long heads held low, they look like so many bearded goats. I thought so. Behind them is a pack of wild dogs, their fur draggled, their tongues lolling. They are in full cry. The giraffes hear them and are away, rolling round the kopje like a ship in a heavy sea. No marrow bones after all. See, the foremost dogs are close on a buck. He has galloped far and is outworn. One springs at his flank and misses him. The buck gives a kind of groan, looks wildly round and sees the wagon. He seems to hesitate a moment, then, in his despair, rushes up to it and falls exhausted among the oxen. The dogs pull up some 30 paces away, panting and snarling. Now, boy, the gun. No, not the rifle, the shotgun, loaded with loopers. Bang, bang! There, my friends, 2 of you will never hunt buck again. No, don't touch the buck, for he's come to us for shelter, and he shall have it. Ah, how beautiful is nature before man comes to spoil it! Such a sight as this have I seen many 100 times, and I hope to see it again before I die. The first real adventure that befell me on this particular journey was with elephants, which I will relate because of its curious termination. Just before we crossed the Orange River, we came to a stretch of forest land some 20 miles broad. The night we entered this forest, we camped in a lovely open glade. A few yards ahead, tambuki grass was growing to the height of a man, or rather it had been. Now, with the exception of a few stalks here and there, it was crushed quite flat. It was already dusk when we camped, but after the moon got up, I walked from the fire to see how this had happened. One glance was enough for me. A great herd of elephants had evidently passed over the tall grass not many hours before. The sight of their spoor rejoiced me exceedingly, for though I had seen wild elephants, at that time I had never shot one. Moreover, the sight of elephant spoor to the African hunter is what colour in the pan is to the prospector of gold. It is by ivory that he lives, and to shoot it or trade it is his chief aim in life. My resolution was soon taken. I would camp the wagons for a while in the forest and start on horseback after the elephants. I communicated my decision to Indaba-Zimbi and the other Kaffirs. The latter were not loath, for your Kaffir loves hunting, which means plenty of meat and congenial occupation, but Indaba-Zimbi would express no opinion. I saw him retire to a little fire that he had lit for himself and go through some mysterious performances with his bones and clay mixed with ashes, which were watched with the greatest interest by the other Kaffirs. At length he rose, and coming forward informed me that it was all right, and that I did well to go and hunt the elephants, as I should get plenty of ivory, but he advised me to go on foot. I said I should do nothing of the sort, but meant to ride. I am wiser now. This was the first and last time that I ever attempted to hunt elephants on horseback. Accordingly, we started at dawn, I, Indabazimbi, and three men. The rest I left with the wagons. I was on horseback, and so was my driver, a good rider and a skilful shot for a Kaffir, but Indabazimbi and the others walked. From dawn till midday, we followed the trail of the herd, which was as plain as a high road. Then we off-saddled to let the horses rest and feed, and about 3 o'clock started on again. Another hour or so passed, and still there was no sign of elephants. Evidently the herd had travelled fast and far, and I began to think that we should have to give it up, when suddenly I caught sight of a brown mass moving through the thorn trees on the side of a slope about a quarter of a mile away. My heart seemed to jump into my mouth. Where is the hunter who has not felt like this at the sight of his first elephant? I called a halt, and then, the wind being right, we set to work to stalk the bull. Very quietly I rode down the hither side of the slope till we came to the bottom, which was densely covered with bush. Here I saw that the elephants had been feeding, for broken branches and upturned trees lay all about. I did not take much notice, however, for all my thoughts were fixed upon the bull I was stalking, when suddenly my horse gave a violent start that nearly threw me from the saddle, and there came a mighty rush and upheaval of something in front of me. I looked. There was the hinder part of a second bull elephant, not 4 yards off. I could just catch sight of its outstretched ears, projecting on either side. I had disturbed it sleeping, and it was running away. Obviously, the best thing to do would have been to let it run, but I was young in those days and foolish, and in the excitement of the moment, I lifted my roer, or elephant's gun, and fired at the great brute over my horse's head. The recoil of the heavy gun nearly knocked me off the horse. I recovered myself, however, and as I did so, saw the bull lurch forward, for the impact of a 3-ounce bullet in the flank will quicken the movements even of an elephant. By this time I had realised the folly of the shot, and devoutly hoped that the bull would take no further notice of it, but he took a different view of the matter. Pulling himself up in a series of plunges, he spun round and came for me with outstretched ears and uplifted trunk, screaming terribly. I was quite defenceless, for my gun was empty, and my first thought was of escape. I dug my heels into the side of my horse, but he would not move an inch. Poor animal was paralysed with terror, and he simply stood still, his forelegs outstretched and quivering all over like a leaf. On rushed the elephant, awful to see. I made one more vain effort to stir the horse. Now the trunk of the great bull swung aloft above my head. A thought flashed through my brain. Quick as light I rolled from the saddle. By the side of the horse lay a fallen tree, as thick through as a man's body. The tree was lifted a little off the ground by the broken boughs which took its weight, and with a single movement, so active is one in such necessities, I flung myself beneath it. As I did so, I heard the trunk of an elephant descend with a mighty thud on the back of my poor horse, and the next instant I was almost in darkness, for the horse, whose back was broken, fell over across the tree under which I lay ensconced. But he did not stop there long. In 10 seconds more the bull had wound his trunk about my dead nag's neck, and with a mighty effort hurled him clear of the tree. I wriggled backwards as far as I could towards the roots of the tree, for I knew what he was after. Presently I saw the red tip of the bull's trunk stretching itself towards me. If he could manage to hook it round any part of me, I was lost. But in the position I occupied, that was just what he could not do, although he knelt down to facilitate his operations. On came the snapping tip like a great open-mouthed snake. It closed upon my hat, which vanished. Again it was thrust down, and a scream of rage was bellowed through it, within 4 inches of my head. Now it seemed to elongate itself. Oh, heavens! Now it had me by the hair, which, luckily for myself, was not very long. Then it was my turn to scream, for next instant, half a square inch of hair was dragged from my scalp by the roots. I was being plucked alive, as I have seen cruel Kaffir kitchen boys pluck a fowl. The elephant, however, disappointed with these moderate results, changed his tactics. He wound his trunk round the fallen tree and lifted. The tree stirred, but fortunately the broken branches embedded in the spongy soil and some roots which still held prevented it from being turned over, though he lifted it so much that, had it occurred to him, he could now easily have drawn me out with his trunk. Again he hoisted with all his mighty strength, and I saw that the tree was coming, and roared aloud for help. Some shots were fired close by in answer, but if they hit the bull, their only effect was to stir his energies to more active life. In another few seconds my shelter would be torn away, and I should be done for. A cold perspiration burst out over me as I realized that I was lost. Then, of a sudden, I remembered that I had a pistol in my belt which I often used for dispatching wounded game. It was loaded and capped. By this time the tree was lifted so much that I could easily get my hand down to my middle and draw the pistol from its case. I drew and cocked it. Now the tree was coming over, and there, within 3 feet of my head, was the great brown trunk of the elephant. I placed the muzzle of the pistol within an inch of it and fired. The result was instantaneous. Down sunk the tree again, giving one of my legs a considerable squeeze, and next instant I heard a crashing sound. The elephant had bolted. By this time, what between fright and struggling, I was pretty well tired. I cannot remember how I got from under the fallen tree, or indeed anything, until I found myself sitting on the ground drinking some peach brandy from a flask, and old Indabazimbi opposite to me, nodding his white lock sagely, while he fired off moral reflections on the narrowness of my escape and my unwisdom in not having taken his advice to go on foot. That reminded me of my horse. I got up and went to look at it. It was quite dead. The blow of the elephant's trunk had fallen on the saddle, breaking the framework and rendering it useless. I reflected that in another 2 seconds it would have fallen on me. Then I called to Indabazimbi and asked which way the elephants had gone.
"There," he said, pointing down the gully, "and we had better go after them, Macumazahn. We have had the bad luck. Now for the good."
There was philosophy in this, though, to tell the truth, I did not feel particularly sharp set on elephants at the moment. I seemed to have had enough of them. However, it would never do to show the white feather before the boys, so I assented with much outward readiness, and we started, I on the second horse and the others on foot. When we had travelled for the best part of an hour down the valley, all of a sudden we came upon the whole herd, which numbered a little more than 80. Just in front of them the bush was so thick that they seemed to hesitate about entering it, and the sides of the valley were so rocky and steep at this point that they could not climb them. They saw us at the same moment as we saw them, and inwardly I was filled with fears lest they should take it into their heads to charge back up the gully. But they did not. Trumpeting aloud, they rushed at the thick bush which went down before them like corn before a sickle. I do not think that in all my experiences I ever heard anything to equal the sound they made as they crashed through and over the shrubs and trees. Before them was a dense forest belt, from 100 to 150 feet in width. As they rushed on, it fell, so that behind them was nothing but a level roadway, strewed with fallen trunks, crushed branches, and here and there a tree, too strong even for them, left standing amid the wreck. On they went, and notwithstanding the nature of the ground over which they had to travel, they kept their distance ahead of us. This sort of thing continued for a mile or more, and then I saw that in front of the elephants, the valley opened into a space covered with reeds and grass. It might have been 5 or 6 acres in extent, beyond which the valley ran on again. The herd reached the edge of this expanse, and for a moment pulled up, hesitating. Evidently they mistrusted it. My men yelled aloud, as only Kaffirs can, and that settled them. Headed by the wounded bull, whose martial ardour, like my own, was somewhat cooled, they spread out and dashed into the treacherous swamp, for such it was, though just then there was no water to be seen. For a few yards all went well with them, though they clearly found it heavy going. Then suddenly the great bull sunk up to his belly in the stiff peaty soil and remained fixed. The others, mad with fear, took no heed of his struggles and trumpetings, but plunged on to meet the same fate. In 5 minutes the whole herd of them were hopelessly bogged, and the more they struggled to escape, the deeper they sunk. There was one exception. Indeed, a cow managed to win back to firm shore, and lifting her trunk, prepared to charge us as we came up. But at that moment she heard the scream of her calf, and rushed back to its assistance, only to be bogged with the others. Such a scene I never saw before or since. The swamp was spotted all over with the large forms of the elephants, and the air rang with their screams of rage and terror as they waved their trunks wildly to and fro. Now and then a monster would make a great effort and drag his mass from its peaty bed, only to stick fast again at the next step. It was a most pitiable sight, the one that gladdened the hearts of my men. Even the best natives have little compassion for the sufferings of animals. Well, the rest was easy. The marsh that would not bear the elephants carried our weight well enough. Before midnight all were dead, for we shot them by moonlight. I would gladly have spared the young ones and some of the cows, but to do so would only have meant leaving them to perish of hunger. It was kinder to kill them at once. The wounded bull I slew with my own hand, and I cannot say that I felt much compunction in so doing. He knew me again, and made a desperate effort to get at me, but I am glad to say that the peat held him fast. The pan presented a curious sight when the sun rose next morning. Owing to the support given by the soil, few of the dead elephants had fallen. There they stood, as though they were asleep. I sent back for the wagons, and when they arrived on the morrow, formed a camp about a mile away from the pan. Then began the work of cutting out the elephants' tusks. It took over a week, and for obvious reasons was a disgusting task. Indeed, had it not been for the help of some wandering bushmen who took their pay in elephant meat, I don't think we could ever have managed it. At last it was done. The ivory was far too cumbersome for us to carry, so we buried it, having first got rid of our bushman allies. My boys wanted me to go back to the Cape with it and sell it, but I was too much bent on my journey to do this. The tusks lay buried for 5 years. Then I came and dug them up. They were but little harmed. Ultimately, I sold the ivory for something over £1,200. Not bad pay for one day's shooting. This was how I began my career as an elephant hunter. I have shot many hundreds of them since, but have never again attempted to do so on horseback. End of part 3.
When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary with Minky Couture, luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.